Today's Teisho will be on Case 4 in the Book of Serenity. Case 4 is entitled, The World Honored One Points to the Ground. Introduction. As soon as a single mote of dust arises, the whole earth is contained therein. With a single horse and a single lance, the lands extended. Who is this person who can be master in any place and meet the source in everything? As the World Honored One was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and he said, "This spot is good to build a sanctuary." Indra, emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground and said, "The sanctuary is built." The World Honored One smiled. The boundless spring on the 100 plants, picking up what comes to hand, he uses it knowingly. The 16-foot tall golden body, a collection of virtuous qualities, casually leads him by the hand into the red dust. Able to be master in the dusts, from outside creation, a guest shows up. Everywhere life is sufficient in its way, no matter if one is not as clever as others. Thank you so much for your excellent practice this morning. Welcome to new arrivals, and thank you so much for coming. I'm so glad you're here. This is another beautiful, beautiful spring day. This has been perfect weather. And last night, when people arrived, the thunder greeted them. It was pretty dramatic. And around 11 o'clock, I went to bed, and the thunder was amazing. Beautiful, beautiful. I can't help but think that the whole point was to celebrate our sesshin. Of course, intellectually, we know that can't possibly be true, right? We know intellectually that, you know, there was a front moving through, it encountered a climate shift, and it produced this thunder and this rain. And you know, that's how modern people think. And it's true, definitely true, in a certain way. It's objectively true, it's empirically true. But all the same, it's not self-deluding to say the thunder greeted the new arrivals, and rocked us to sleep on the second night of our sesshin. You know, we live in a world of impersonal causes and conditions. You know, so it's going to rain whether or not you want it to rain. And, you know, in the Native American tradition in the Southwest, you know, after a long drought, they have a ceremony to summon the rain. And sometimes it works. You know, the rain actually comes. Sometimes it doesn't work. And we Western people, you know, we modern people look at that and say, you know, those poor Native Americans, don't they know it's an impersonal universe? I definitely believe in science. You know, I definitely believe in science. I just went to the doctor and had a checkup. And I went because I had a slight infection, and he took a tissue sample, or a culture rather, not a tissue sample, and prescribed an antibiotic, and you know, within a week the infection was gone. I'm feeling better, and I'm so glad science exists. But actually, something's gained and something lost, right? Because the modern world is, in some ways, just a world of impersonal and even like lifeless causes and conditions. So, you know, because we know that rain is produced by a front coming in and encountering, could be a cold front coming in and encountering a body of warm air producing the thunder and lightning, we think it has, you know, we go to the next conclusion and the next step in the logic and say, it has nothing to do with me. Whether I'm here or not doesn't matter. And I think that's a mistake. I think that's a mistake. It's definitely true that a cold front encountering a mass of warm air produces thunder. But I also think it's a mistake for us to therefore think we live in a world that is completely disconnected and impersonal. And that's the way we live today, and I think it's gotten us into a huge amount of trouble. You know, modern people have to be forgiven for their confusion because you know, their history has made them what they are. But you know, the modern way of living has big problems, and you see it all the time. I mean, I can easily understand why people would think of forests as sacred. When I go backpacking, a few years ago I was in the Wallawas in eastern Oregon. And it's on the Oregon-Idaho border. And I remember hiking up to the top of this mountain and just looking out at this alpine lake, and the clouds were reflecting in the alpine lake like in a mirror, as though in a mirror. And it was not just breathtaking. I completely disappeared as a Zen practitioner. I recognized what was happening to me. You know, I went into instant samadhi, and all sense of self disappeared. And I became 100% one with that beautiful lake, those mountains, the wind moving through the valley, and the wind coming through the valley made the early summer flowers like Indian paintbrushes and quiver. And I can easily see how somebody from another culture would say, this is like sacred. You know, this is sacred. You can't cut these trees down. You can't put a road through here. You know, that would be such a big mistake. You know, have you no respect? And And there are definitely people who would say, are you out of your mind? You know, it's just a mountain. It's just it's just a lake. You know, we could say the farmers need that water. You know, we've got to put in a pump house. We've got to put in a... And I agree that, you know, the farmers do need water, you know. And we do have to, you know, manipulate our environment to survive. I'm on board with that. But on the other hand, when we look at the earth or look at the world around us more generally as the lifeless, like almost like a machine, just the functioning of impersonal causes and conditions, I think we wind up in a very sad place. You know, we will cut the trees down, we will put the road in, we will, you know, and somebody coming by later, at a later date, looking at the valley we treated in this way will, you know, say, well, this would be a great place for a burger stand. You know, and I've actually had experiences like that. I remember long ago, I'm not a very well-traveled person. I don't travel much, mostly because I like just to do zazen. And I'm not criticizing people who love to travel, you know. But I had the chance to go to the Virgin Islands on a sailboat for 2 weeks, and I am not a sailor, I'm not physically troubled by like the water, but I just don't like sitting on a boat all day, you know. So we would get to these islands, the Virgin Islands, the British Virgin Islands, and the first, I just couldn't wait to get out of the boat and get on the land and start walking. And there are these beautiful, beautiful islands, you know, and you can walk up to the top of some of them and look out, and there you can see it's an island floating in a beautiful turquoise sea. And you can't quite see the curvature of the earth, but you just see these islands in the distance in the middle of, it looks like nowhere. And the sun, you know, catches, as it's coming up over the horizon, catches the water and it's sort of gold shading into blue. And it's breathtaking, right? And I remember hiking up this mountain side and stopping and looking out, and somebody had built a little house. It was a little square, really, we would almost say like a shack. It was made out of cinder block. And as I recall, it's the Caribbean, right? So the house was painted pink, and there were turquoise shutters. And it was on this hillside all by itself. And I was walking up the hill myself, or up this mountain myself, and I looked at this little house, you know. And then I looked out at the water, and just then it is as though like central casting had sent the extras in. These guys pulled up in a big jeep, and they were like drinking like mixed drinks. And they were in shorts and Hawaiian shirts, and they looked out and said, you know, this would be a great spot for a motel, you know, a hotel. I was like, no, no. And I'm sure they love their families and that they want a happy world too. But nevertheless, you know, they are distanced. And I agree that somewhere there has to be a hotel, you know, and I would rather have a hotel in a nice place, you know. But, you know, I think we're too, I can, many times when I lived in Seattle, you know, I would go hiking in the Olympic Mountains, and you're in this beautiful rainforest. And the trees are covered with Spanish moss, and it's dense, that the the ground, the moss on the ground isn't like moss in New Jersey. I mean, we should be proud of our moss, you know, here in New Jersey. But the moss in Washington State is incredible. It's like 3 inches thick. And so you're like walking on a like shag carpet of moss. And, you know, you're going through this forest and the shag carpet of moss is underfoot and moss is hanging off all the trees and it's deeply green, you know, and shadowed. And then you turn a corner and you come out and you look and the whole hillside has been denuded. It's a shock. It's like, oh my gosh. And they might leave like one poor little tree standing, you know, because he was in a dense grove, he doesn't have any limbs all the way down to the ground. It's like the tippy top has some limbs. So, you know, I understand we need paper products, you know, and I understand we need housing material. But all the same, I think we live in a, you could say, like a disenchanted or lifeless world to some degree. And we do have our, I would say, substitutes, right? So, you know, we have holidays, we have Memorial Day, we have Labor Day. You can go down the shore and spend a day at the beach, and that is a wonderful time. Don't do it on either of those holidays. Do it on a Thursday, right, in the middle of the week when nobody's down there. But all the same, you know, those are exciting times. But it's not, you know, it's not, I think, the same as like feeling your deep connection to things. And people get little glimpses of that. You know, they do. They go out to Sandy Hook, and you're riding a bicycle, and that's a wonderful experience, by the way. And you look out at the ocean, and the breeze is in. You smell the salt water. That's so great. You know. But I still think we live kind of in a disenchanted world. And so, you know, when we hear the thunder, we appreciate it. You say, oh, that's cool. But it's not, that wasn't really meant for you, right? That wasn't really meant for you. That's true in a certain sense. But in another sense, you know, this way of living makes us strangers to everything in the world around us, including ourselves and other people. You know, so people too become, you know, sort of somewhat unreal to us, somewhat mechanical too, I think, a little bit, sometimes. So, you know, I would say Zen is about... Zen comes from a different world civilization. And it has a different outlook on reality, and I think it's quite real. It's just different from our culture's outlook on reality. I think that when we practice Zazen, you know, we're sort of like finding our way back to something that we as a society maybe forgot about. And what we are recovering is that sense of everything as intimately connected to us. You know, I wouldn't say it's in an egotistical way, right? I mean, it's definitely possible to say, for somebody who's very narcissistic. I mean, I won't mention a huge narcissist who runs the country. But probably that narcissist thinks the world is a show put on for his benefit. I'm actually sure he doesn't think that. I think he's deeply alienated from everything around him. And he's so alienated that he's always in a relationship to everything and everyone of manipulating his surroundings to get the results he wants. And so everything is an object of his manipulation. There isn't any other relationship except to manipulate something. And it's coming from a place of real, profound illness, alienation to the point of illness, and his narcissism comes out of that alienation. A part of what he's doing is trying constantly to manage his appearance in order to get the results he wants. So in some ways, he's a product of exactly what I'm talking about. So I think that there's another way to exist. And I would say that Zen comes from a different culture. And it shows us a different way to be in the world that's not disenchanted, but not narcissistic. It's not disenchanted, but it's not self-centered. So, you know, when you come to Sesshin, and the thunder and the lightning is crashing overhead, you could say it's a coincidence. It means nothing. You could say that the universe is welcoming you to Sesshin, and I think in a certain sense that's really true. I really do. I think if you are able to trust in the unfolding of things, if you are able to become one with the world around you, everything becomes alive and welcoming to you. And I don't think that's an illusion at all. I think that's a healthy relationship to the world. You know, I remember meditating at a session long ago where the thunder and lightning was crashing around. And I said to Genki Roshi something like, "Wow, that's so beautiful." And he said, "Where is that thunder coming from?" And I said something like, "Well, you know, I don't know, outside." He said, "No, it's coming from you." And I didn't get it. You know, it took me a long time. And he said, "When you're farther along, you'll understand that that is coming right out of yourself." And he meant that the boundary between yourself and the world, if you do Zen long enough, begins to dissolve. And you experience everything as your own body. And again, I would say this is a healthy relationship to the world. You know, people wouldn't dream of opening the window of their house and throwing the trash out the window onto their lawn. But, you know, about a year ago, my wife and I were hiking down a country road and somebody opened the window and threw the trash out of his truck, you know, basically. And it was this beautiful place. We were visiting some friends in Vermont and it was just like he just threw the garbage out the window. But he wouldn't do that in his own, I don't think he would do that in his own yard. So, you know, we identify with our yards as who we are. But we don't identify with this country road as who we are. So we can trash it, right, literally. Well, I think Zen, it changes the way we interact with the world. Everything becomes alive. Around day three of Sesshin, you will begin to have the experience of, you know, when your mind is not clouded by projections and anxieties, fantasies of various kinds, terrifying and entertaining, distracting, you begin to experience things in an, you could say, unmediated way, without any a film or distance. So when you hear the thunder, you are 100% thunder. You know, when you feel the heat, you're 100% heat. You know, this is a different way of living. So I think this has the effect of making the world alive again. Moment after moment, you know, the world which our habits, our mistaken ways of thinking have made lifeless comes back to life, becomes like sacred. You know, in Buddhism, there is a teaching of the enlightenment of grass and stones. And Western philosophers just can't figure that out. You know, if a stone doesn't have a brain, how can it become enlightened? You know, this teaching of the enlightenment of grass and stones, of trees and rivers, how can that be enlightened? They don't have brains, right? So those Buddhists who believe in the enlightenment of grass and stones are like those Native Americans who are out there with their snakes praying for rain, right? But if you understand that there's no boundary between yourself and the world, and that boundary is like imaginary or constructed, then it's quite possible to think of all things as part of a continuum, right? That's alive. And that in a way our samsaric view is to see them as not alive. This is, I think, makes sense if you do enough zazen, right? Everything becomes alive. Everything becomes like one body. And, you know, this is why how you put your shoes against the wall actually matters, right? I mean, if you just think, well, they're just shoes, and they can't think, they're not thinking beings, you know. But everything is thinking being. Everything is sentient being. If you don't draw a line between yourself and the world. And so, like, how you put your shoes against the wall is just as important as how you might plant. You know, I do a lot of gardening. If you put the plant in the ground carefully, not you don't bust up the root ball. You water it. You know, if you care for the plant properly, it will grow into this big, beautiful plant. So it's not so different. Taking care of the world it includes just, you know, putting your shoes down properly. So what this means is that the way we practice Zen is not the way people think. You know, we have, we work with entering deep mushin. And we watch the breath until you can enter deep mushin, and then the teacher gives you a koan. And koans basically are wonderful, wonderful devices because they kind of cannot be answered from the standpoint of an alienated consciousness. And yet they invite a response from an alienated consciousness. You know, when we are given a koan, we usually try to resolve the koan intellectually. You know, it's begging for you to try. So in this case, you know, as the world-honored one was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and he said, "This spot is good to build a sanctuary." And then Indra, the emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground and said, "The sanctuary is built." So this is a classic koan, right? I mean, we would say the first part is clear enough. The Buddha's walking with his congregation and he says, "This is a good spot to build a sanctuary." So if you know anything about Zen philosophy, you will say, of course, you know, Buddha nature is everywhere. See, of course, Buddha nature is everywhere. And if you go into the teacher and you say, Buddha nature is everywhere, you know, there's nowhere it's missing, that's just an intellectual answer. In fact, actually, that's an answer coming from a place where it is impossible to experience Buddha nature. Yes, truly. And so the koan helps us a little bit because it says something that is philosophically easy for us to get our minds around if we know Buddhist philosophy. But then it messes it up a little bit. It shakes it up a little bit because then Indra, the emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground and said, "The sanctuary is built." See, now it becomes intellectually complicated because is Indra making fun of the Buddha? Is he agreeing with the Buddha? And how can a blade of grass be a sanctuary? So now we can spend some time thinking about how can a blade of grass be a sanctuary? But of course, every blade of grass is a sanctuary, blah, blah, blah. Now the koan is inviting us to do some good interpretation. And if we're good interpreters, we could come up with an interesting interpretation, interesting reading of the koan. But if you respond to the koan and it's begging you to do it, you see, if you respond to the koan that way, you're actually falling into the trap of entering the kind of consciousness that will be guaranteed to produce the alienation you're trying to overcome. And so if you have fallen into this, if you've been doing training with koans for a while and you've fallen into this trap 100 times, please don't be embarrassed. You know, Master Mumon and Wan Wu and other anthologists of these koans basically set traps everywhere you turn, trying to get you to step into them. And that's part of how we recover from our alienation, right? I mean, alienation is something we all experience and have to overcome. Maybe even Native Americans have to overcome it. Maybe even ancient Japanese had to overcome it. I mean, that's why people do zazen. You know, we have experiences in life that injure us and that undermine our trust. And so we create a mode of being that is walled off from the world around us. And that mode of being is safe because it's separate, right? I remember my brother was very athletic, and he used to be, when he was about 13, my brother was quite interested in impressing the girls with his physical prowess. I myself could not do that, but my brother was in excellent physical shape and was actually like just a handsome person. And when he was 13, he was an idiot, like all 13-year-olds. Where we were living, cars would drive by at a moderate clip, and my brother would, I can remember my brother was talking to some girl he had a crush on, and he was acting cool. And as the car drove by, my brother reached out his hand, he was just going to tap it as it drove by to show what a cool guy he is. See, I'm so cool I can take a little risk and just tap. And the car actually detached his finger from his finger bone. So he had to go to surgery. He was in surgery for like 8 hours. And actually, they put it back together. It's this modern science. Yeah, so great. They put my brother's finger back together. And that was so incredible, you know. He just was staring at this bone sticking out of his hand, right? We have experiences like that, and you know, you can be sure that's the last time my brother tried to touch a car. And it's a good thing too, right? It's like when you're a little kid, you know, your mother says, you know, the bulb is out of the light, you have a lamp, and the bulb has been unscrewed. And you think, if you're a little kid, you think, what if I stick my finger down in there? Right? What will happen? And your mother says, don't do that, you know. And you stick your finger down there and you get a shock, right, you know. So you don't go around doing that anymore. But actually, you don't stick your finger in a lot of things after that, right? You realize, don't do that. You know, it's dangerous to do something when you don't know what you're doing. Don't venture into unknown territory, right? So you get that lesson 1,000 times and you begin to be very careful. So you know, we form, ancient people, even ancient Japanese people must have fallen on their heads or tripped over rocks or lost a finger, you know, when they're cutting rice or something. And it undermines our trust in the world. So, you know, alienation is something we all have to recover from. And the ceremony, like the rain ceremony, the Indian rain ceremony, is, you know, you trust in the world. If you think about, like, being a farmer, what an amazing life that is. I'm so glad I'm not a farmer. You know, it's like you put these crops in the ground and then you just hope it rains, right? It's like, wow. You know, we take it for granted, but that is so amazing. What if it doesn't rain? If sometimes it doesn't rain, and you must get up in the morning and think, okay, is it going to rain? Is it going to rain? Is it going to rain? Right? And, you know, now, if there's a famine, you know, we have an international food system, right? So if you have a famine in Texas, you know, it's true they have to sell the cattle and stuff, but nobody really dies. But in the old days, you know, if it didn't rain, people died. You know, that was it, you know. So you know, basically it takes so much trust, and then when you get a drought, it undermines your trust in everything, right? And I think the rain ceremony is not really about producing rain. It's about restoring trust and a sense of connection in the universe. You know, the universe has hurt us. And we're going out with our snakes and we're beating our drums and we're saying we insist on our interconnectedness. We insist that we're part of you. And this is restoring, you could say, that connection that seems to have been broken by nature, right? Nature's broken the connection. It's broken a connection. But we're sort of insisting, remember us. You know, we're all part of the same life. And if it does its job, it might not produce rain, but it does restore that sense of trust, see? Well, you know, Zazen is about restoring that sense of trust. You know, we sit down on the cushion and, you know, especially if we're dealing with a koan, we're we're given a question that really is usually about something that has eroded our trust. You know, and then, you know, we try to solve the problem using our intellectual faculties, but actually that doesn't restore the trust. That does, it actually reinstates the boundary between ourselves and the world. Often, anyway. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we do zazen, we descend into emptiness. And in deep samadhi of emptiness, you know, we begin to experience the world as part of ourselves. And in that condition, we can begin to work through the koan. See, the koan is asking us to recover from some kind of a split between ourselves and the world. And it's reminding us that we can only recover from that split by going into emptiness and dropping the small self. And so the method of the koan is to remind us of our separation from things around us and requires us to go into emptiness in order to restore our broken trust. And life seems to break our trust a lot, right? You go to the doctor and the doctor says, sorry, you know, there's some spots on this x-ray, you know. You were just planning your new retirement, you know, something like that. If you learn the art of emptiness, going into the deep, deep emptiness and dropping the self, you know the secret, right? The secret to always restoring that connection no matter what happens. And we all have challenges. As soon as a single mote of dust arises, the whole earth is contained therein. With a single horse and a single lance, the land's extended. Who is this person who can be master in any place and meet the source in everything? And when we hear that, you might think, yes, you know, the master everywhere. But, you know, that's a kind of a temptation or a seduction. It's not about mastery. It's about learning how to let go, right? So to be the master wherever you are doesn't mean you strut around, you know, I'm in command here. Right? It means you're a master of emptying yourself out. And that's the secret that the koan is talking about. As the world-honored one was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is a good place to build a sanctuary." Indra, emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." The world-honored one smiled. The boundless spring on the 100 plants, picking up what comes to hand, he uses it knowingly. In other words, if you can drop out of your small self and connect with the world, you always have this ability to respond creatively. The 16-foot-tall golden body, a collection of virtuoso qualities, casually leads him by the hand into the red dust. So, you know, it's like the Buddha leads you into the red dust. Red dust is a symbol of, confusion. But if you're able to restore your broken connection by dropping into emptiness, you see, nothing frightens you anymore, not even walking into the red dust. Able to be master in the dust, right? from outside creation, a guest has shown up. It's like, look, you know, if you read the newspaper, it says we've got 20 years, and then global, you know, there's going to be famines, blah, blah, blah. You know, you could read the dire reports, and it all may be true. You know, it all may be true. So you know, basically, we have a lot of challenges facing us. But no matter how terrible the challenge, you know, if you can become one with what is happening around you, you know, it's fine. It's fine. You know, you become one with the thunder. You become one with the rain. Even experiences that can seem painful and difficult, you become one with, and then you have this like indestructible life. Everywhere, life is sufficient in its way if you can do this, no matter if one is not as clever as others. This is much more important than being clever. So please restore your broken connection on the cushion today as we go into this third day of Sesshin.
Shujo Muhen Seigan.